Good evening, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Nick Blumberg. Chicago says goodbye to a civil rights icon and a political force of nature.
I'm a person of faith. The faith must fight unjust law.
On the field of life, his shoes were well worn.
He was a freedom fighter and a towering voice for justice.
Reverend Jesse Jackson dies at the age of 84.
Illinois has suffered through similar hardship before, and we know the way out.
Governor J.B. Pritzker unveils his budget proposal, facing a $2.2 billion deficit and massive uncertainty over federal funding.
We're forging a relationship that will be the foundation of a public-private partnership leading to construction of a world-class stadium.
As Indiana legislators advance a bill aimed at luring the Bears over state lines to a site near Wolf Lake, Illinois lawmakers are caught off guard, saying they had productive negotiations with the team this week. Meantime, City Council punts on a measure aimed at ICE accountability and rejects empowering residents to report parking violations. Under pressure from elected officials, the Cook County State's Attorney outlines a policy for prosecuting federal immigration agents. And after a long legal battle, clergy are allowed into the Broadview Detention Facility for Ash Wednesday Ministry. And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Mitchell Armantrout of the Chicago Sun-Times, WTTW's own Heather Sharone, WBEZ's Michael Puente, and Maxwell Evans of Block Club Chicago. Thank you all for being here. Busy week and lots to get to. Before we get to those stories, there was big breaking news today as the Supreme Court blocked President Trump's sweeping tariffs in a 6-3 vote, with the president saying he's ashamed of the justices who opposed him and refusing to back down. Let's take a listen.
Other alternatives will now be used to replace the ones that the court incorrectly rejected. We have alternatives. Great alternatives. Could be more money. We'll take in more money.
All right, Heather Sharone, the president says he's got alternatives, different authority he can use. But, you know, given his proclivity for pushing the bounds of the law, do you think we may see future legal challenges to his tariff schemes?
Sure. We saw in Justice Kavanaugh's dissent, he laid out a roadmap for the president to use other legal authorities to do the tariffs. But it will be more complicated, and it will give Democrats a chance to sort of pounce on this issue now that there's this ruling from a Supreme Court that has ruled over and over and over again in favor of the president. In fact, late today, Governor J.B. Pritzker sent the president an invoice for $1,700 on behalf of every Illinois family. He says that's what the tariffs have cost Illinois residents. And on our behalf, he wants that money back. He, of course, is weighing a 2028 run for president.
Yeah, Pritzker not one to miss an opportunity to jab at the president. All right, well, let's get to the story that's been on everyone's minds this week, the death of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, an iconic figure in civil rights, in politics, in civic life. But Maxwell, you spoke with some folks who knew him differently, who knew him as their neighbor. How did folks in South Shore remember him?
Most definitely. So a lot of South Shore neighbors, which is actually the neighborhood I live in as well, right up against the Jackson Park Highlands neighborhood where he called home, where his family still calls home. So many neighbors remembered him not only as the powerful public figure that he was, but as a friendly person willing to share hot links at a barbecue with you, or to say, God is so good at a birthday party or a Christmas party. It was really kind of a magical experience getting to see how many people kind of saw him in this personal lens as opposed to all the historical remembrances, all the ways that he was remembered as a political figure.
Yeah, and I mean, talk about that a little bit. You had a great obituary outlining his very active life in the public arena. Was there something in there that particularly stood out to you?
Yeah, so I think about how his community work really was at the center of even his national pushes, his international presence. I think back to his time as the founding director at the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization back in the 60s, going all the way up to 2025 when I saw him at a conference to push back against DEI rollbacks in companies. You just saw him at all of these neighborhood events, at all of these community events, in a way that you would not really expect to see the Reverend Jesse Jackson at a neighborhood meeting, at an Operation Push meeting out in the community. And so, yeah, just hearing reflections from neighbors as to this human being that they got to see as opposed to a demigod or anything above human, it was really kind of inspiring that anybody can kind of take that presence, anybody can take that motivation and inspiration.
Yeah, he really didn't slow down right until the very end almost. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Mike, looking over his life, working with Dr. King, runs for president, organizing boycotts, protesting the Oscars. I mean, he really is just kind of a figure who's everywhere you look in 20th and 21st century history.
Absolutely. I had a few times covering him, especially he was very close to the late Gary Mayer Richard Hatchard. He was very instrumental in the historic 1972, the first black political convention in Gary, where they had so many different African-American politicians. So he was close to that family. So I had a chance to talk to him in Gary and at different political events. So he was a dynamo and he was on the front lines. A lot of people maybe take shots at him, but when you're on the front lines of that kind of movement, the civil rights movement, you're gonna get shots.
Yeah, I feel like pretty much all of us at this table probably have like a Jesse Jackson story. Certainly as a reporter, I mean, like my first year at the Sun-Times, I was at a press conference and somebody came up and smacked me on the back really hard and started talking to me like they knew me my whole life.
Yep.
And I'm looking at Jesse Jackson and I'm like, this is the guy I read about in textbooks. Obviously, you know, just a genius at conjuring media attention for the causes he supported. But on a personal level, like a really fun person to report on.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a similar experience when I was producing a political campaign for him here years and years ago that we had an in-person audience. And he just started chatting to me like we'd known each other our whole lives. And I was sort of dumbstruck, like, what's happening here? I mean, Mitch, you wrote, too, this week about how, you know, his role in politics helped open the door for a lot of Democrats. What's his legacy there?
His legacy stretches long and far and wide, most notably perhaps in the presidency of Barack Obama. Looking back at Jesse Jackson's 1988 presidential run, literally changed the rules of how Democratic primaries are run, with candidates taking up. He essentially, with the voting block that he garnered that race, he was able to push for proportional awarding of delegates. So, you know, it used to be a winner-take-all affair in these contests. And that was one of the key things that led to the nomination of Bill Clinton and eventually Barack Obama. They kind of had their own personal beefs behind the scenes, but, you know, we heard from a lot of folks talking about how important, obviously, that was to Jesse Jackson and obviously the entire black community to see an African-American man elevated to the White House. But really just he was an inspiration to generations of politicians in Chicago and beyond.
Well, you think of what's going on in the whole controversy with immigration enforcement and getting into the Broadview ICE facility. I kept thinking back to myself during the summer, if there's one person who could have gotten in there, it was Jesse Jackson.
Yeah, he was.
And so that's the kind of personality, the nature of him that we're missing now.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when he made his appearance at the DNC last year, or in 2024, rather, the room was up for grabs when he came out.
Well, it was not by mistake that Kamala Harris used a slogan that he coined. You know, her slogan was, "When we fight, we win." Mm-hmm. That started with Jesse Jackson. It was picked up by the Chicago Teachers Union. You know, if not for Jesse Jackson, of course, Barack Obama would not have been president. But it goes even back further and more locally in Chicago. If not for Jesse Jackson choosing to make Chicago his home, Harold Washington would never have been mayor of Chicago.
Yeah.
And that, I think, transformed Chicago politics. And he spent decades fighting the dailies, generations, and then fought Ed Burke and fought Ed Verdoliak. And he is at once both a national figure of political significance, but also intensely important here in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, talk about that role at City Hall. He was no stranger.
He was not. He was there fighting for what he saw as the regular person. And I think it's important to understand that the whole notion of a cross-racial political coalition did not exist before Jesse Jackson. He is somebody who reached out to Latino communities. He reached out to the Appalachian community in Uptown. He built on the work of Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers in Chicago. His legacy is so deep in Chicago that it can be a tendency, I think, for us reporters to just sort of, it's always been that way, right? So you can't really sort of see it for the sort of the impact that it has. And, you know, I think it is, I have reflected this week about how perhaps on a national stage, his legacy was, or his persona was more of a punchline than it ever was in Chicago. Chicagoans, we can be a provincial people, but if you adopt Chicago, we will adopt you back. And Jesse Jackson may not have been born in Chicago, but he was of Chicago.
Through and through. I mean, talking about the breadth and depth of his work, Maxwell, does it feel like we have someone like him with that stature, with that cachet in civic life right now?
I think in hearing from a lot of at least my neighbors on the topic, it's kind of that Reverend Jackson inspired them to stand as that person individually and to come together collectively. I don't think there's really an appetite for, in community organizing at least, one person to kind of stand up as a figure to be worshipped or to stand up as a figure to dominate over others. I think really looking at the coalitions that Reverend Jackson was able to build, what a lot of my neighbors take from that is the power of coming together, the power of unity in your community. And so that's what a lot of these reflections on his life had focused around.
Yeah, carrying forward his values, but not necessarily just one singular figure.
Truly.
Yeah, well, a remarkable life. We could easily do the full half hour on the good Reverend, but a lot of other things happened this week. Mitch, Governor Pritzker presented his 8th budget proposal on Wednesday. He's pitching it as sort of a cautious, prudent budget. What did we hear from the governor?
He said basically that this is sort of a status quo budget because there are a lot of threats to funding under the Trump administration. His budget address last year, he likened the Trump administration to the early days of Nazi Germany. Didn't go quite that hard this time around, but really tried to get home the point that the billions of dollars that have been clawed away from the Illinois government and billions more in other states, that's really the reason that we have to scale back a lot of the social service programs and other progressive measures that he's really championed in the first 7 years of his tenure. That he's looking to extend to 12 years running for governor this year. Not really rocking the boat this year. There's this idea of a new social media tax, charging companies like Facebook and Twitter for the number of users in Illinois. I think that's likely to face a court challenge. It's an idea that Brandon Johnson has also championed in Chicago. So kind of a rare point of maybe coordination for two folks who've kind of butted heads in the past to find some common ground. But obviously the budget that gets presented in February is not the one that's going to pass by the end of May. So it's going to be an interesting few months ahead.
And it was interesting to hear from Republicans in Springfield reacting to the speech who kind of agreed with a few of the governor's points, maybe not full-throated agreement, but a lot of them were basically saying this was just a 2028 stump speech.
Right, yeah, that's kind of the main complaint a lot of Republicans have against the J.B. Pritzker's. They say he's using this as a stepping stone towards the White House, devoting a lot of time in a budget address to federal issues that they say are not pertinent here. But that's what the governor sort of brings to the table.
Yeah, I think we'll probably be hearing that complaint a lot more over the next couple of years. Heather, the governor's also calling for overhauling zoning laws around the state, trying to get more housing built. Lots of folks love the idea, but as any city hall reporter knows well, zoning is a very touchy issue locally. I mean, I expect he's going to face some pushback on
that. He is, and not just from Chicago, because while there is no doubt a housing crisis in Chicago, and in Illinois, and Pritzker sees this as a way to sort of speed up the pipeline of creating new homes and new apartments and new condominiums, it is perhaps more loved in theory than in actuality, because there's nothing that makes people more angry than the thought that they might not have control over what gets built in their neighborhood. And that is a lesson any Chicago alder person could tell you in great detail. And what this would essentially do would prevent sort of some of these roadblocks that we've seen from blocking big apartment buildings that are designed to let people have access to public transportation and other issues. This is one of those proposals where the devil is in the details, but it would be a sea change in sort of who gets to build what and who gets to have that final say. And it is not something that is going to be just opposed by Chicago, but we're also talking about suburbs who really sort of guard their ability to include sort of rules that means you've got to have, properties of no more than a half acre or an acre. This would sort of undo those restrictions. And while everybody wants to build more housing, maybe not everybody wants it to be right in their backyard, so to speak.
It seems like there's an acronym for that. I can't quite think of it. All right, Mike, you're our Northwest Indiana expert at the table. Sounds like lawmakers are now setting their sights on a location in Hammond near Wolf.
Wolf Lake for a possible Bears stadium, but there's been so much back and forth. What do you make of things?
That's right. I mean, every hour I get a new text message from somebody saying, hey, now it's Arlington High. Now back to Northwest Indiana. You know, this is far. I went to the press conference yesterday in Hammond, and God bless them. God bless the mayor of Hammond, Tom McDermott. He really wants to cross that finish line, the goal. But there's still so much that needs to be done. Already you are hearing rumblings from people in Porter County who's going to have to pass a food and beverage tax to help finance this. Lake County's going to have to do the same. There's going to be an admission tax. So it's far from being done. You still got the State House that has to approve it, and the governor's going to sign it. They say they're going to do this, but there's going to be a fight on their hand. We're not quite there yet.
Yeah, there's a lot to happen. And, you know, Indiana lawmakers moved ahead with this bill, but, you know, the Bears are applauding that. That didn't sit so well with the governor and other Illinois politicians.
No, the governor's staff had just had their latest three-hour meeting with team officials and some of the Chicago Democrats who are trying to reaching some sort of consensus for the Bears to stay in Illinois, presumably in Arlington Heights. Chicago is essentially off the table at this point. You've got to give Bears PR sort of credit for, you know, the discussion over the last few years is, are the Bears going to leave Chicago? And now that's kind of accepted as a given. Now it's just, let's keep them in Illinois at any cost. But yeah, Mike, like you were saying, I mean, just wild watching this Indiana House Committee. Like, there are elected officials, like, choking up at the prospect of this happening. If you listen to sports talk radio around Chicago, you would think the sky was falling yesterday.
Yeah, right.
And it's hard to, you really can't overstate how far away this is from actually happening. The Bears have not even identified a spot in Hammond where they would actually do this.
Right.
They're talking about doing it around a golf course that's across the street from an oil refinery. It's built over a landfill, an old industrial landfill.
Yeah.
It's near a beautiful natural area. To say that it's like a tough road ahead is an understatement.
Yeah.
The one thing I do got to say, where the mayor of Hammond was kind of correct in this, if you put it in downtown Chicago or leave it at Soldier Field, doesn't still do much for the city, and you put it in Arlington Heights. Arlington Heights already a beautiful suburb. This would catapult Northwest Indiana really into the 21st century. It needs something to boost it up, to bring people backwards to Northwest Indiana and the region to spend their money there. This would definitely do that.
Yeah, that could be a big, you know, point in its favor.
Yeah, and I would also say the southeast side of Chicago abuts Northwest Indiana immediately. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people may even forget that there is a southeast side, which when I live in South Shore, it's not possible. That's my home community.
Yeah.
So I'm always thinking about how it would be so much quicker for me to get to the Indiana border, to get to Hammond, to get to Northwest Indiana, than it is to get to Arlington Heights. Frankly, I don't know how long it would take. I don't know how far it is away even, but I know exactly how I would get to a Northwest Indiana site. So there are still so many details to be worked out, but it's not as if this is way out of the way or anything.
I feel obligated to point out that the state of Illinois is still paying hundreds of millions of dollars for the renovation of Soldier Field back in the early 2000s. Before, we heard Governor Pritzker say, hey, if the Bears want additional help for a new stadium, how about they help pay off the debt for the old stadium? And I think, you know, that's a big question. And, you know, It is one of the very big complications in all of this. And we have been through this so many times. We were saying before the show, okay, it's going to be Arlington Heights. Nope, back to Chicago.
Right.
Back to Arlington Heights. And I think there's a lot of whiplash, right? That is making everybody somewhat skeptical that this is actually really a thing.
And not that it's not a beautiful park, but I will add we're paying tens of millions of dollars for the new Comiskey that's 30 years old. So lest we forget.
It will be new to us always.
Yes, exactly. All right, well, Maxwell, this week marked Ash Wednesday, the beginning of the season leading up to Easter. After a long court battle, clergy were finally allowed into that Broadview detention facility. Were you surprised to see that it took legal action, that DHS took such a hard line on something where you have to imagine that's pretty bad optics to most folks across the political spectrum not to allow ministers in?
Well, to be honest, I think we're far past the point of optics. I mean, you look at outside of Broadview, there were clergy being shot at with prepper balls, being shot at with riot-controlling materials. We're so far beyond the conversations of optics that it truly isn't surprising to me that it did take a legal battle to get something that seems so simple.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether this, you know, signals a greater openness. We've finally seen, you know, lawmakers being allowed in to inspect the facility, but, you know, certainly a lot of questions still around the conditions there. All right. Well, Heather, a lot of the news at City Council this week was about what didn't happen. They didn't override the mayor's veto of a hemp ban. And tell us about the push to have Chicago's police watchdog investigate whether CPD is cooperating with immigration agents. What's happening
well,
there?
Well, one of the big issues we confronted during what the Trump administration called Operation Midway Blitz was whether the Chicago Police Department was following both the letter and the spirit of the Welcoming City Ordinance, which prohibits all city employees from helping federal agents enforce civil immigration laws. Now, Superintendent Larry Snelling and Mayor Brandi Johnson says that they had done everything by the book. There are many Chicagoans who are not quite so sure. But there's a loophole, essentially, in city law. It's not clear who has the authority to figure out whether those violations are actually taking place. So a group of city council members led by Alderman Andre Vasquez and Alderperson Jesse Fuentes got together and said, well, let's give the Civilian Office of Police Accountability that power. It was set to be approved, but four conservative members of the city council used a procedural measure to block a vote. It will come back at the next city council meeting, whenever that might happen to be. It is not clear to me that it is in danger of failing, mm-hmm. But it's clearly a hot button issue, especially as everybody sort of waits for the weather to warm up again. It got warm, it got cold. That's spring in Chicago, or almost spring in Chicago. And if agents return to Chicago in large numbers, I think you're going to see a distinct outcry for the city council to take quick action.
Yeah, obviously, you know, they're building the plane as they fly.
Indeed.
It'll be interesting to see what COPE is actually able to do in these instances. Well, you know, Mitch, sticking with immigration issues for a minute, Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke came out with a policy for when her office might charge federal immigration agents with criminal misconduct. This follows a public spat with the mayor. It follows pressure from Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Do you think electeds leaning on her maybe factored into the push for finally releasing this policy?
Yeah, I think she really didn't have any choice but to at least take some sort of more stronger public stance on, you know, her approach towards the federal government in this respect. I think looking at the policy itself, at least when I look at it, it sounds a lot like prosecutors might look at just about any criminal defendant. Just this idea of basically, you know, accepting evidence from investigating law enforcement agencies, evaluating if a crime has taken place, impaneling a grand jury if, you know, if that's needed to sort of decide if charges are warranted. But really, I think the only thing that distinguishes it is this idea of determining whether or not federal agents or federal law enforcement exceed the powers granted to them. So really, like, not anything too radical in this policy, as far as I can tell. But, you know, making a public statement about it, you know, yeah, the order from Brandi Johnson, she pretty much had to make some sort of response for her own agency.
Yeah. All right. Well, jumping back to City Council for a minute, Alder people also rejected a pilot program that would have let residents send in pictures of cars illegally parked, blocking lanes. Mike, do you think this maybe just felt a little too big brother for Alder people to get behind?
Absolutely. When you're talking, they're going to be sending in hundreds or thousands of pictures. How are they going to go through all that? So it seems a little impractical.
Yeah, I mean, does it feel like there's any hope for this pilot to come back? There was a lot of enthusiasm about it from its backers.
Sure. I think the problem is that there were concerns that this was going to sort of turn everybody into parking enforcement agents, and that it could potentially lead to violence if somebody is, you know, parked illegally and they see somebody taking a picture of them. You know, do they make a bad decision? I also think the other problem is that Chicago's downtown relies on delivery trucks being parked illegally. And the sense was, especially from Alderman Brian Hopkins, he was saying, look, this could come to a place where these deliveries stop happening at all, and that could threaten the restaurant industry. So there are a lot of questions about sort of how this would work in practicality. But it is drawn from a desire of just greater enforcement of parking laws across the city.
Yeah, and I would definitely say that as a cyclist, I understand there are all of these problems and all of these problems to be worked out before any sort of legislation went through. But at this point, I'm just waiting for some sort of protections. If protected bike lanes are too much, if the enforcement is too much, if the monitoring is too much, it just gets to a point where I would like to see some sort of safety improvement actually pass through. So biking through Chicago streets is a very dangerous thing. I know firsthand there's got to be some sort of solution we can come to actually make this safer.
Absolutely. It can be very treacherous. The four of you, not treacherous at all. A great panel, but unfortunately we are out of time. So our thanks to Mitchell Armantrout, Heather Sharone, Michael Puente, and Maxwell Evans. We're back to wrap things up right after this.
Tonight's presentation of Week in Review is made possible in part by Ann and Rich Carr, BNSF Railway, and Francine and Dr. Anthony Brown. Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
And that's our show for this Friday night. Now for the Week in Review, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay informed. Have a great weekend. All right, our friends over at Axios Chicago reported on quite the lawsuit. Judge dismissing a claim over boneless wings at Buffalo Wild Wings, saying the complaint has no meat on its bones and did not drum up enough factual allegations.
Oh, congratulations to that judge.
Good for you.
He got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does anybody go into B-dubs thinking that the boneless wings are actually something created in, like, God's natural universe?
Chicken nuggets. I go because they are chicken nuggets.
Right. And that's just fine.
That's the whole deal.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and sponsor of programming that offers continuing education to fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.